Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Tuesday, August 4th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by Liza and Peter. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. And thank you, all of you out there, for listening this morning. We'll be reading the Boston Globe, Liza and I, like we do every Tuesday. And I almost dropped the computer. That would be wonderful. Okay, and the park, today's headline. My stand is falling apart.
I got it.
Okay.
All right, why don't you, you fix it. I'll start reading.
All right.
Okay, so I'm going to take over while Pete tries to fix his computer stand over there. This is articles from the front page of today's Globe. Question of fraud again hits program. AG investigating whether Mass Housing gave funds for safety work not done. A second case of apparently phony invoices paid by the state's Affordable Housing Finance Agency is under investigation by the Massachusetts Attorney General after Mass Housing officials determined they had given hundreds of thousands of dollars for work that wasn't done. At the center of the dispute is Hunter Foote, the founder of Vandenberg Sober Living, who received grants from Mass Housing totaling around $700,000 to install fire-air sprinkler systems at nine of his sober homes, most of which the state is demanding he pay back. The allegations closely resemble those in a recent Globe Spotlight Team report that found two developers with hidden connection to a top Mass Housing executive had submitted fake invoices for more than $500,000 to a program intended to boost affordable housing in the gateway cities. In the Vandenberg case, a sprinkler installer told the Globe that Foote had done something similar, using a legitimate invoice from when the contractor previously did work for Foote to create phony ones for other locations where he did little or no work. Stephen D. Liberto of WAM Fire Protection said the bogus invoices on his letterhead featured his electronic signature, which he disavowed, and specified that various payments were due forthwith. I don't use words like forthwith, DiLiberto said, calling himself just the sprinkler guy, moderately intelligent. Nope, I leave that for reporters and highly educated college guys like Hunter. That's for people who are smarter than I'll ever be. After consulting with DiLiberto, the conducting inspections in late 2024 and early 2025, Mass Housing determined Foote misrepresented the extent of work completed at seven sober homes and told them to return the agency's money. In three cases, inspectors found no work done at all, no work at all had been done, according to the letters, though the grants had been mostly fully paid out based on invoices submitted by Foote and his associates. All told, the agency demanded Foote and the associates give back more than $430,000. None of it has been returned to date. Paul McMorrow, a Mass Housing spokesman, said the agency takes allegations of potential fraud and noncompliance seriously. He noted staffers took immediate action after identifying discrepancies in the sprinkler program in 2024, demanding the return of the money and referring the matter to the Attorney General. The sprinkler program and problems with Gateway Cities grants were both referred to the Mass Attorney General, whose office confirmed to the Globe it is investigating both matters. In an interview with the Globe, Foote denied any wrongdoing and said he doesn't believe he owes the state anything. He acknowledged preparing the disputed invoices, but said if there were any inflated claims of progress, they were based on assertions from DiLiberto, whom he trusted at the time. He said he paid DiLiberto for all the work listed on invoices and then billed the state. Foote said he eventually completed all of the jobs, except for two, where he determined sprinklers weren't needed under local law, and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money to do it. He said he submitted voluminous paperwork to Mass Housing documenting compliance more than a year ago, but it's been radio silence for a long time. He did not share the paperwork with the Globe, which requested it. The Fire Sprinkler Grant Program is the second program overseen by a now former Mass Housing official in which guarantees have been accused, in which grantees have been accused of submitting and receiving payment for bogus invoices for work that was not performed. The Globe Spotlight team reported in June that developers Gary Aqua and Reggie Woods, who received $1.4 million in grant money from Mass Housing to rehabilitate blighted apartments in Worcester and Pittsfield, submitted invoice claiming more than $500,000 in work was done by at least nine subcontractors who said they didn't do the jobs and weren't paid for them. Many of those subcontractors had done other work for Aqua and Woods, and they believed the pair used their earlier invoices as a template for fake ones. Both programs were overseen by Tony Richards II, who resigned in July 17th as Vice President of Strategic Community Initiatives for Mass Housing. His departure came 3 weeks after the Globe reported he had steered the Gateway City's grant money to Aqua and Woods months after they sold Richards a home in West Roxbury for $204,000 less than its original list price. For the sprinkler program, Mass Housing could not provide the Globe with contractor invoices and other records related to payments to Foote and his affiliates, citing an exemption in the public records law for documents that are part of an open investigation. The fire sprinkler safety program was designed to cover most or all of the cost of installing sprinklers at sober homes around the state amid new regulations. The program offered up to $80,000 to sober homes that had been in operation for at least a year and certified by a nonprofit association. But as with the grants in the Gateway Cities Housing Program, Mass Housing did not inspect the sprinkler installations before it paid the bulk of the work, a Setup One watchdog group criticized. Any system of internal controls that relies on trust is not a system of internal controls, said Mary Cotnan, Director of Government Transparency at the Pioneer Institute, a right learning think tank. On-site inspections would obviously be the best solution. Conton added, it would make sense for Mass Housing to take a really close look at their policies, especially because this is the second kind of incident where this has happened. The seven homes where the state is disputing the payments are all linked to Foote, a Worcester entrepreneur who operates sober homes in Springfield, Taunton, New Bedford, and other locations, and also offers franchising arrangements. Foote acknowledged challenges with getting sprinklers installed at the time properties for which he received grants. Ultimately, he told the Globe, work was completed at all but two at a cost of more than $900,000, significantly more than what he received from Mass Housing. He said the scope of work at the two incomplete jobs had been scaled back for valid reasons. Foote denied knowingly submitted fake invoices. He said the request for payment he made on DiLiberto's letterhead reflected the contractor's assertions of how much work he had completed at the time. However, he declined to say how much he paid DiLiberto for work that he now alleges the contractor did not do. Foote has not filed a lawsuit seeking to recover money from DiLiberto. What really matters, Foote said, is that the sprinklers were eventually installed. We're ready to address any concerns, Foote said, but we need to know what they are and what we need to do about them. If it's a permit closeout, we'll close it out. We spent more money than was disbursed to us by a significant factor. It did take a long time, and it was very frustrating, but it all got done. DiLiberto, for his part, flatly denied Foote's claims. He's a worthless piece of expletive who continues to lie about everything, DiLiberto said. Moreover, in at least three cases, public records raised questions about Foote's assertion that the work was completed satisfactorily. In Taunton, Deputy Fire Chief Robert Bastis told the Globe the city had not approved any sprinkler system at two properties for which Foote received grants. From our perspective, there are no fire sprinklers, no building permits, no fire inspections on record for those properties, Bastis said. Likewise, in New Bedford, a permit application for a sprinkler system at the Vandenberg Sober Home was rejected by inspectors with the city's Department of Public Infrastructure in late 2024. No permit was ever approved, officials said. Fluke provided the Globe with documents showing a private firm had inspected those three systems in July 2025 and said there were no deficiencies observed. Mass Housing's contract with grant recipients says all jobs must be inspected and approved by municipal authorities. Foote did not respond to a question from the Globe about why some of the Vandenberg jobs lacked such a designation. Records show the firm that did the inspections, Tristar Fire Protection, has taken out a lien on Foote's New Bedford sober home over unpaid bills of more than $16,000. Since the problems were discovered in 2024, Mass Housing has made some changes, according to agency officials, including immediate reinspection of all sprinkler projects and new protocols requiring multiple inspections of such projects in the future. Originally, the sprinkler program imposed no deadlines. The program's current rules require work to be completed in 12 months with the possibility of a six-month extension. It does not appear Mass Housing's board, which is appointed by the governor, was made aware of the problems its staff discovered in either the sprinkler program or the Gateway Cities program. The Globe could not find records of any discussion in board minutes. Board Chair Gene Pinedo declined to comment, deferring questions to the agency's communication office. A Mass Housing spokesman also declined to comment. Six of the board nine members were appointed by Governor Maury Healey, who has said little about the problems at Mass Housing. An internal audit by Mass Housing published late last year made cryptic reference to recent control improvements to some programs under Richard's oversight after management had self-identified shortcomings. McMorrow, the agency spokesperson, said it had revamped grant application intake and evaluation processes, clarified design standards, created a new grant closing checklist, improved invoicing and disbursement processes, and instituted mandatory third-party construction inspections. Wow.
That's a lot.
It's like they had to redo the whole thing because they're a bunch of thieves. Over to you, Pete.
Yep. Gotta love Boston. Anyway, let's go on the second try for this particular article. We have fixed, I believe, all the mechanical issues here, and we're getting back to full function. And from the Nation section of today's Globe, Park Service finds the arch could detract from historic places. President Trump's proposed 250-foot-tall triumphal arch would change the skyline of Washington to such an extent that it would intrude on views at dozens of historic sites around the Capitol, according to an assessment by the National Park Service staff. It would disrupt the symbolic relationship between the Lincoln Memorial and the Arlington National Cemetery, obstruct sight lines on the Kennedy gravesite and Robert E. Lee's home, and alter what official documents call one of the most magnificent views in Washington at the National Cathedral, 4 miles away, the Park Service said. The assessment of the arch's impact on surrounding historic properties is a key step the administration must complete before the project can receive final approval by the National Capital Planning Commission, which could come as soon as at its next meeting on September 3rd. The Park Service is supposed to seek ways to reduce such adverse effects on historic sites under the National Historic Preservation Act. But the arch is expected to move forward with little change, given that Trump has shown no interest in the most obvious remedies, scaling down the project or building it somewhere else. Precisely because the arch was designed to be so large and prominently located, it's taller than the Capitol's height limits allow and more than twice as tall as the nearby Lincoln Memorial, it would be visible from many significant sites around Washington, altering what are considered defining characteristics of these places. The recently updated list of affected sites, which the Park Service has asked outside groups to comment on by Thursday, is notable for its length and the many major buildings and surrounding districts and landscapes on it. These adverse effects are intentional and inherent in the design of the arch. It is intended to dominate the surrounding landscape, wrote Roger Kirchen, Virginia's State Historic Preservation Officer, in a June letter to the Park Service after it began the review. Adverse effects means you're building something that will irreversibly harm the experience in these other locations, said Ed Stierili, the Vice President for Government Affairs with the National Parks Conservation Association. Given that the administration is expected to proceed anyway, he said, the list looks like a reflection of the career civil servants and the Trump's political staff contradicting each other on paper. The assessment is part of what's known as Section 106 review under the state preservation law, which requires federal agencies to consider how a wide range of undertakings, new courthouses, road expansions, pipeline limits, would affect sites that are on or eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. The law prescribes no particular outcome, but is meant to get agencies to pause, consult experts and the public, and consider alternatives or design changes. State preservation officials in Virginia and Washington and other organizations have charged that the arch review has been rushed and began too late for meaningful change. The review started after the site was selected and after the design was approved by another federal panel. David Maloney, Washington's historic preservation officer, proposed an alternative location on the Anacostia River due south of the Capitol, a solution that appears off the table as the White House sprints to complete the project before the end of Trump's term. The Park Service did not respond to requests about the review process. As the administration moves swiftly through the review, it is simultaneously pushing to overhaul the rules governing historic reviews nationwide, curbing public transportation and the kinds of places and harms that would be considered. New regulations are unlikely to take effect before the arch review is complete. The harms identified by Park Service staff largely describe changes to the settings and views of historic sites, not physical damage to them, but the sight lines, surrounding landscapes, and symbolic links to other monuments and memorials are documented features of their historic designations, one that shape how the visitors experience these places today. The arch would interrupt a carefully planned corridor between the Lincoln Memorial and Lee's Arlington House that was designed to symbolize the reunification of the North and South after the Civil War. From Lee's Memorial, much of the Lincoln Memorial would be obscured by the arch.
Mm-hmm. Get rid of the arch.
Well, I vote no.
I vote no.
It doesn't matter what we think.
Okay, I'm going to read another article from the front page of today's Globe. Controversial contract sparks another suit. Mismanagement alleged in courthouse bid process. For the second time in as many years, Governor Maury Healey's administration is being taken to court after a large state contract became mired in controversy, finger-pointing, and allegations of conflicts of interest. The latest round of high drama and accusations of potential mismanagement involves a $2 billion award for a new courthouse in downtown Springfield to a team stuffed with well-connected Boston figures. One of them, the interim head of the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority, has since stepped away from the project. Aiming to blunt criticism, state officials released a variety of bid documents while facing a lawsuit. The Healey administration has already weathered one controversial procurement after its award of a contract to develop 18 highway service plazas to a lawsuit and led the winning bidder to pull out. While it isn't unusual for losing bidders to sue over a procurement bid, former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger said the back-to-back controversy sent a message that money and power matter more than competence and integrity. If you're the governor and the attorney general, you can't just stand back and say, that's our process, said Harshbarger, who also ran for governor on the Democratic ticket in 98. It reflects negatively on public interest and leadership. The Springfield courthouse at issue was built in 1971, is infested with mold, and is making people sick. The state solicited proposals for a new building in 2025 and ultimately awarded a $2 billion contract to a group called Liberty Junction, which is made up of a real estate firm from Virginia, F.D. Stonewater, and Kojo Real Estate, owned by John Barros, now interim executive director of the Convention Center Authority, and Conan Harris, husband of U.S. Representative Anya Presley. The team listed Boston Suffolk Construction as its general contractor. On Thursday, Healy spoke at an unrelated event in Springfield with Barros at her side. She defended the courthouse bid, saying that it followed the standard procurement process and that litigation could be common in these types of bids. In a statement last month, state trial court leadership said that Liberty Junction projected a thoughtful layout would allow natural light into the courtrooms and could be accessed by both public transportation and nearby highways. The plan also offered the most competitive price, trial court leaders wrote. Healy called the Liberty Junction bid high quality and also argued it was $300 million below the next lowest bid. I don't know about you, she said, but I think that makes a lot of sense. Barros was unanimously appointed to his position in January, one of the members of the convention board who voted for his appointment as Healy's budget secretary, whose office also oversees the agency that awarded the Springfield Courthouse contract, the Division of Capital Assessment Management and Maintenance. Two of the losing bidders, Springfield auto magnate Jeb Belis and real estate developer Dinesh Patel, teamed up to sue Liberty Junction and the Capital Asset Division, asking the court to rule the agency violated the conflict of interest law and also declare Liberty Junction ineligible for the contract. The parties are set to appear in court August 11th. Barros on Wednesday announced he was divesting from Kojo Real Estate and the project at large, saying through his attorney that its significant public benefits outweigh his personal interests. Sounds suspicious? In Springfield, many local elected officials have said they're frustrated with the results, despite the state's reasoning that it was the low-cost option. Hampden County Sheriff Nick Cochi, whose son works as a court officer in Springfield, said the illnesses suffered by those who work in the courthouse feel personal. The state, he said, put a tremendous emphasis on the cost instead of a locally based bid. We had an opportunity for an A+, Cochi said of the bid process. In my opinion, we got a C-. Last June, the administration came under intense scrutiny for a different procurement when the Mass Department of Transportation had selected a team led by Irish retailer Apple Green and Boston Suffolk Construction for the rest area revamp of the state service plazas. Global Partners, which already runs four of the plazas outright, was the losing bidder for the contract and waged a campaign against the decision in the press and in court. Apple Green ultimately withdrew from the negotiations altogether, and state investigators later said the process was riddled with flaws. The project is now being rebid. Mass DOT's procurement process has been shrouded in secrecy, and a complaint in the lawsuit argued that friendly text messages between a Mass DOT official and Suffolk Construction executive should disqualify Apple Green and Suffolk from winning the bid. The controversy around the Springfield courthouse has a different flavor, ethics experts said. Whenever you see that a government official also receives a lucrative personal benefit from the government, it's going to raise questions, said Kedrick Payne, Senior Director of Ethics at the Campaign Legal Center, a Washington, D.C.-based watchdog. Eric Petrie, an attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice, said even in instances where there is no proven conflict of interest, just the appearance of one can still harm faith in government. When the public sees insiders benefiting and their concerns going unaddressed, it fuels the sense that the government only works for the select few, said Petrie. Petrie said he witnessed a troubling backsliding of trust in government in the last several years. That's particularly true at the federal level. But he warned it can trickle down to state and local government, too. When scandals emerge and when abuses are uncovered, it draws attention to the fact that there was an issue, he said. When people see this, they think, this is how it is, that all politicians are in it for themselves. Those in Springfield who've said they already feel disenchanted with the process question whether the cost savings Haley boasts will be worth it in the long term. When a group of court employees ranked the submitted bids, the Liberty Junction proposal was near the bottom of their list, said Hampton County Clerk of Courts Laura Gentile, adding that the procurement for the project sure looks like a political failure. Speaking from her office in the aging Springfield courthouse, where she said raw sewage has been leaking onto the carpet, yikes, Gentile said she felt like choosing the lowest bid felt like a consolation prize. We're not stupid out here, she said. Seeing what's going on is a slap in our face. Wow. That doesn't sound very healthy. Over to you, Pete.
Thank you, Liza. And from the world section of today's Globe, Tehran sees Trump move as losing power. When President Trump appeared to back down once again from a threatened military escalation against Iran, he offered fresh fodder to the narrative Iranian officials are eager to promote. They are not the ones who fear war. Trump is. Iran's leadership believes it has found the world's Achilles heel. With the help of regional militia allies, Tehran spent the past week underscoring its ability to threaten several of the world's most critical energy facilities and waterways. It has continued to up the ante in its face-off with Washington over when and how to stop their renewed hostilities and return to a short-lived deal to start peace negotiations, which fell apart last month. When Trump signaled in recent days that a major escalation was imminent if no concessions were made, two former Iranian officials said Tehran's leadership told them to go right ahead. They're ready for war and they won't back down, said Emil Azmozawi, a former Iranian diplomat who said he had met over the weekend with the team surrounding Iran's head negotiator and Speaker of Parliament, Mohammad Bagher Khalilzadeh. Al-Musawi described an exchange of messages between U.S. and Iranian officials sent over the weekend through Pakistani and Qatari officials, in which he said Trump vowed a severe attack on civilian infrastructure like power plants if the Iranians did not restart negotiation. The Iranians refused, he said, unless Washington returns to the previously agreed Memorandum of Understanding, which many experts say was in Iran's favor. We have no problem with war at all, and we're ready for the big confrontation, Al-Mazawi said the Iranians told the Americans. Trump told the Iranians, I will hit the power in Iran. So the Iranians said, if you strike, we strike. This sounds like it's not going to get anywhere fast.
Nope.
Iranian officials have spotted a pattern in Trump's attempts to shape negotiations, said Sassen Kamiri, a former senior Iranian government official and a professor of Iranian studies at the University of Tehran. Whenever their messages are exchanged, Mr. Trump starts to pressurize the situation by threatening Iran so he can try to get further concessions, he said. But Iran is not so easily manipulated. On Sunday, Trump said he had relented from his planned escalation after Iran and other Middle Eastern countries requested a delay because the perimeters of a deal had been agreed to. Yet there are no outward signs of any return to U.S.-Iranian negotiations. What does appear to be happening is that Saudi Arabia and Qatar expressed concerns over their ability to adequately defend their oil and gas facilities, according to two regional diplomats. The official Saudi news channel said Sunday that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman